Hello, everybody. It's Jackie. And have you noticed lately that there's a whole lot of body politicking going on around this election year? We're doing a lot of talking about abortion bans and IVF, contraceptives, women's agency over their body versus the baby's rights. And I'll have to be honest with you, I don't really know what the Bible or Jesus has to say about all these things because I haven't done the deep work. And I know that many of your pastors haven't either. You know, many of us are in conservative evangelical communities where we've been trained to be what's called received knowers. Received knowers do not construct their own knowledge, they receive it. They depend on authorities to tell them what's right or wrong. To a received knower, there's only one right interpretation, one right answer to a problem. Paradoxes, ambiguity can't be tolerated. Ideas and life are to be predictable and laid out. Received knowers won't read or attend or participate in anything their authorities haven't recommended for fear it could lead them astray. Does that sound like you and me, maybe? And one of my goals through the Marcella Project is to help move us from received knowers to critical thinkers, especially when it comes to spiritual issues that impact our lives, issues like IVF and abortion. And that means doing our work. And so I started researching and then came like a car screeching to a stop to avoid a crash. I just stopped doing the research because it occurred to me that when we talk about hot topics, whether it's abortion, immigration, racism, book bans, well, there's more at play than just what we think. We bring our experienced reality, our emotions, our preconceived beliefs to the table. Emotions play a role in how we think. So maybe we should start there.
Welcome to the Jackie Always Unplugged podcast, where we're having off-the-record conversations. I'm Reverend Dr. Jackie Reese, founder and president of the Marcella Project. As a pastor, preacher, and thought leader, I've walked with women of faith for decades and had thousands of conversations about what women encounter solely because they are women. At work, family, their faith, with relationships, sex, the church, their bodies, and Jesus. On this podcast, we're going to be asking hard questions, dealing with real issues, and revisiting scripture with a new lens. These conversations are going to put words to your female experience. They're going to ennoble you as Jesus intended and encourage you to bring your full self to the table. It's here we're going to reshape our view.
Welcome back, everybody. Today, I'm joined with Karen Smith. And Karen, can you share a little bit about who you are with our audience?
Yes. Hi, friends. I had the joy of getting to know Jackie in Northern Seminary, where we studied women and theology together. I am also a traveling speaker, so to say. I have the joy of using that gift at several churches in our area. And I am also a visual artist currently working with two professors to illustrate a book on Jesus and women.
I love it. Okay. Karen and I are going to, you know, pelt some questions at Becky Miller today. And Becky Castle Miller is a PhD student at Wheaton College studying New Testament with Esau Macaulay. Her dissertation research is about emotions in the Gospel of Luke. She writes and speaks on emotional, mental, and spiritual health in the church and offers emotional coaching. She graduated from Northern Seminary, where she studied underneath Scott McKnight. Her discipleship workbook with Dr. McKnight is called Following King Jesus. And she and her husband and their five kids and cat returned to the United States in 2020 after living in the Netherlands for 8 years, where she served as a discipleship director at an international church. So welcome, Becky. We're glad to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so it's election season, as everybody knows. And right after the election, we move into Thanksgiving, where we're going to find ourselves sitting at the dinner table with family and friends that we disagree about issues that each of us have really strong feelings about. And we don't always know how or why we get so worked up, you know what I mean? But we seem to be unable to have healthy dialogues anymore. And so I was hoping you could help us understand ourselves better by talking about those emotions. So first, Becky, tell us exactly what emotions are or aren't, because I think I was raised and many of my listeners were raised to think that there's logic and then there are emotions and they're two separate things and they're even unequal things, right? Like logic is thinking and that is good and feelings or emotions are bad. So is that the correct way for us to understand our emotion?
That is not the most scientifically accurate way to understand emotions. And as a PhD student researching emotions and the Bible, I definitely find myself wanting to footnote all of these answers. I should give you one sentence and then three footnotes to explain everything.
I love footnotes. I read all of them.
So let me try to give the footnotes in the answer. There are a lot of different theories of emotion. There are philosophical views of emotion. There are psychological views of emotions. There's neuroscientific views of emotion. I see the most advancement happening right now in the neuroscience of emotion. Like, how does our brain make emotions? So the theory that I am working with in my dissertation is from Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett, who looks at the psychology and neuroscience of emotion. And her theory is the theory of constructed emotion. And again, it's a theory, and there are a lot of theories, and some of them complement each other, and some of them kind of argue with each other. But the one that makes the most sense to me is this idea of constructed emotion. And that is that emotions and thinking are kind of all part of the same process. Emotion is a whole brain, whole body process. And emotion is heavily influenced by our culture and our personal history. So according to this theory, emotion is the meaning that our minds make out of our body's sensations based on our past experiences, the vocabulary for emotion, and the paradigms for emotion that we've inherited and grown up with, that we've been influenced toward by our socializing figures like our parents, pastors, teachers, politicians. We learn what emotions are acceptable in our culture, in what situations, and we learn how we are and are not allowed to display them in our culture. And sometimes this is even gendered. Men in some cultures are allowed to construct certain emotions and women are allowed to construct others, and those don't always overlap. Every culture has their own emotions. And one reason I like this theory is because it allows for so much cultural variation in emotion, and it ties in with sociological theories of emotion like those from Bacha Mesquita, who is a cultural and social psychologist and looks at how different languages and different cultures have different emotions. So emotion is big and a little bit ambiguous, but it is this meaning-making process. So I'm walking on the sidewalk and I see a car veering toward me and my body starts to predict that I am in danger and I start to have these body sensations, then my mind will construct the most useful emotion that will keep me safe in that moment, which is going to be fear. Because fear is going to activate other body systems that are going to help me move quickly. Like fear will activate my fast twitch muscles and it'll increase my adrenaline. I'll be able to get out of the way of the car. So it's this whole body, whole brain process that is choosing the most effective emotion concept for that moment that's going to best balance my body and keep me safe in the world.
Wow, that was beautifully explained.
That is beautiful, Becky. Do you think within that theory that we all have primary emotions like joy or distress, anger, disgust, fear, and surprise? Or do you see those as different?
The idea of primary emotions belongs to different emotion theories than the one that I'm working with. If emotions are indeed this meaning-making process and they are socially located and socially constructed, I don't think there can be such a thing as primary emotions because everyone is going to have a different range of emotions that are their go-tos based on their own personal history. If someone was taught that sadness isn't acceptable for Christians, they're going to have a hard time accessing sadness because they're going to have neural pathways formed that push them toward constructing other emotions. When they're sad, they got to make it into something else because sadness was disallowed socially. So the idea that there are a few primary emotions that are consistent across cultures has been pretty thoroughly debunked by Dr. Barrett's work.
Okay, that makes sense. So here's another weird question. Do you think God has emotions? And why do you think God created us with emotions?
I do think God has emotions, though God doesn't have a body in the way that we have bodies, but Jesus has a body in the way that we have bodies. And so Jesus has had and has emotions. Like Jesus in his resurrected body at the right hand of the Father right now is still constructing human emotion because Jesus is still human and Jesus is still embodied, which blows my mind. So today,
I was just going to say pause on that because our listeners go, what?
Wait, what?
let me channel Dr. Cherith Fee Nordling, who was my theology professor at Northern. Cherith, one of the most beautiful teaching legacies she gave me was this idea that Jesus still has a body. Of course he does. Of course he does. He was resurrected in a body and he ascended in a body. Where do we think his body went? I don't know, but we tend to picture Jesus as disembodied, but he's not. Like his resurrected body is still human. He is still fully God and fully man. And so Jesus right now today is constructing human emotion toward us. Jesus feels grief and feels joy and feels anger when he sees what's going on in our lives. And I believe that, and I think this is so beautiful, like it makes me emotional to think that Jesus sees what's going on in my life today. And his emotion on my behalf fuels his intercession for me.
Mm. I got to add to that because I just had a pastoral thing that went down. I had a woman who's called me and been married for a long time, and she's thinking about leaving her husband. And her first question to me was, do I have the right to make the call? Will God be angry at me? Mm-hmm. And the reason she's been pushed to leave is her husband is doing some things that are very damaging. And she has pleaded and pleaded and pleaded for that to change and hasn't. And all I could think of is exactly what you just said, Becky. I thought, well, first of all, there is no right or wrong here. And second of all, no, God's not mad at you. In fact, what God is feeling right now is deep sadness at your pain. I would imagine crying over her pain, over his pain. But it was interesting. The first thing she thought was God would be mad. Mm-hmm. And I thought, no, the first thing God is feeling is sad.
Yeah. Well, I do emotion coaching, and I often tell primarily women I work with, I have some male clients, but primarily women, I so often have to tell them, God is angry, but God is angry on your behalf. God is angry at the people who have harmed you. And so the anger that you're feeling is valid and is a reflection of God's desire for justice for you. So it's a lot of validating women's emotion. And so I think that, yeah, Jesus probably is angry, but not at her.
Right. I agree. He's angry at the injustice. And I suspect he's even sad toward him because he's seeing he's not making his potential. And he's sad about why he's a little boy inside doing what he's doing to himself and his family, right? Like there's all of that going on also.
Yeah. So Jesus has emotions, certainly. And we see that in the Gospels. And actually, my dissertation work is on how Jesus shapes the emotions of his followers in the Gospel of Luke specifically, because dissertations have to be very specific.
Yes, they do.
My master's thesis was on Jesus' emotions in the Gospels. So yes, it's undeniable that Jesus has emotions. God has emotions. We see so many characterizations of God by the Old Testament writers depicting God as emotional. And because God doesn't have a body, whatever it means for God to be emotional is different from what it means for us to be emotional. But I think that because God created us in God's image, whatever God's emotions are, God created us with the physiological structures to construct emotion so that we as humans can image God in God's emotionality in the same way that we image God in all other ways, which is on a small human scale. But yeah, whatever it means for God to be emotional, and God is emotional, God created us with the ability to image that in some way.
Okay, I have to bounce off that just for a second, because what that makes me realize then, when you say physiological, it means we have to, those of us particularly who have come out of the Enlightenment age, who it's all about knowledge, who it's about thinking, right? That would be a lot of conservative evangelical communities. What you're telling me is my body actually has been wired with the capacity. And of course, the body encompasses the brain. I have to remind everybody of that. The brain is actually in the body.
It is.
It's not separate. It's an organ in the body. But we have to maybe pay more attention to our bodies and what they are telling us than we've been maybe perhaps taught to, correct?
Our bodies are a huge part of emotion.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I read this book, Emotional and How Feelings Shape Our Thinking, in which the author stated this thing that kind of surprised me. Mm-hmm. He said, emotions help us to sort out the meaning of the circumstances we encounter, especially in complex, ambiguous situations. And in those in which we must make a quick decisions, emotions act as internal guides that point us in the right direction. And that's what threw me. What? Because I've been taught, don't trust them, which, by the way, I came into the church later in life. I never bought that. That is what I was told, right? But here, this man's saying, no, 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 our emotions act as internal guides and point us in the right direction. And he argues you can misfire your emotions and go in the wrong direction. But more often than not, your emotions are driving you in the right direction. What do you do with that?
I think that's true. And that is actually something I argued in my master's thesis, that Jesus's emotions fuel his obedience, rather than being something that detracted from his obedience to the Father. So in the same way that I think Jesus's emotions fuel his obedience in intercession today, Jesus's emotions inspired, motivated, helped his body take action toward obedience. Our emotions do reveal our values because it is a constructed process. So the values and goals that we focus on and invest in are going to shape the kinds of emotions that we construct because our emotions help us take action toward our goals, right? If I want to protect myself and the car is coming toward me, my fear is going to help me get out of the way because I value saving my life. Or if my child is in danger, I value saving my child's life. If I am out for myself and I'm at the grocery store and the last package of cookies that I want is on the shelf and someone else is going for it, if my value is self-service, I might like feel like, no, that's mine, and feel, I don't know, covetousness maybe. And I might grab the package of cookies away from this other woman who's reaching for it. But if I've cultivated in myself a value of selflessness and other service, I'll be like, oh no, you take them. Go ahead. I can get some more another day. So the emotion that I could construct like compassion or mercy in that moment or kindness and be like, oh no, you have it. So my values that I've cultivated over time are going to shape my emotions. So if I've cultivated bad values, my emotions may not move me toward good things. If I've cultivated pride, self-sufficiency, destructive anger, malice, envy, like if I've really cultivated those values and those emotions, that is what I will construct. And so in that case, my emotions might move me in a bad direction, which is why I argue that our emotions need to be discipled. Our values need to be discipled, our goals, our focus need to be discipled, and our emotions need to be discipled so that our emotions do move us in the right direction. So Jesus at Gethsemane, the writer of Hebrews tells us, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. So like Jesus's cultivation of that emotion helped him obey. So I think that emotion helps us obey if we disciple it.
So what exactly does it look like to disciple our emotions?
Right. That's a long answer, but I'll try to give the short one. Discipleship means looking at Jesus as our socializing figure and letting him shape our lives in all aspects, our prayer life, how we handle money, how we use our words, etc. So it means looking to him to shape our emotional life, which means adapting our values and priorities and goals to the kingdom of God so that the emotions we construct are in keeping with the culture of the kingdom of God, so that our emotions are moving us toward Christ-likeness and toward taking those like loving, self-sacrificing actions of Christ-likeness to the people around us.
Wow, that was beautifully said. You mentioned anger, and I want to go back to that particular emotion because women seem really angry during this election season, if you watch. And we actually saw that anger kind of start in 2016, the Women's March after Trump was voted into office. And it seems to have remained. Women are a little bit at battle over these issues. And as women, we've been socialized that anger is not allowed, mm-hmm. and that it's a bad emotion. And yep. So you said something that kind of threw me. Again, I'm like relearning what is all this, but you said anger isn't an important emotion that helps motivate us to take action for change in the world. Yeah. Often those actions for change make the world a better and safer place for vulnerable people. Anger helps us protect ourselves and those we care about. Mm-hmm. So where do you see anger playing out in women during this election season?
Anger is a really important emotion, and I don't think there's any such thing as a bad emotion. I don't even like to say bad emotion. I don't even like to say negative emotion. I think that emotions can be comfortable or uncomfortable. It is what we do with them that can be destructive or helpful. Even cultivating like resentment, if we use it to withdraw from people or harm them or retaliate, resentment becomes destructive. But if we tune into that sensation of resentment and realize it's telling us something about our boundaries being violated and where we need to stand up for ourselves, then resentment becomes a really healthy and helpful emotion. So that's just an example. So anger can be a destructive force. It can be used to harm people, but anger can also give us the strength to stand up for ourselves and for others. We often feel or construct anger when our path is blocked, when we are trying to get somewhere or do something and that is thwarted. So if women are working for freedom
and equality and safety and self-protection and the protection of other women. And those goals are being thwarted by politicians and policies. It makes complete sense for women to be angry. And I would say that that anger is helpful because it is motivating important social change.
So bottom line is there might be righteous anger.
Yeah.
And it's really about how we take that energy in motion, in action, to bring justice that's actually healthy, good, and should be.
Exactly.
And I would say as a pastor to women for 30 years, that includes when there's domestic violence.
Absolutely.
Sometimes your anger is exactly what you need to move you in ways that are healthy in that marriage.
Yes.
And so don't lose your anger. Use your anger, I guess, is what I would say.
Yes. And I do, both as a pastor and as a coach, support a lot of, and as a friend, support so many women in abusive relationships. And when women can get angry, that is when things change. When they can access that anger for themselves, then they find their strength and the ability to get themselves out and or stand up for themselves and set boundaries and be safe. Yeah.
Lovely. So I started preparing a salon about abortion and IVF because those are hot topics on women's minds right now during this election season. And I remembered something that I had learned before, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, and that when you challenge a person's belief, you think that if you give them evidence, right? Like a salon, what we do is we provide evidence on multiple sides of the argument, and we don't give the answers. We just say, mm-hmm. here's where this group thinks, and here's how they've built their argument, and here's where this group thinks, and here's how they built their argument. Where does it say it in scripture and history, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera? And then it's the question of, so where is this argument strong, and where is this argument weak, and where do you see those kinds of things? And what's interesting is you would think that if you can present the fact, right, that you would change someone's belief or someone's position. But there's this thing called backfire effect that I've read about. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's this idea that when you present evidence that a person's belief doesn't think is true, they simply dig in and believe their position more strongly. And let me just give you an example. I sat with a woman who has is just absolutely confirmed in her mind that abortion is murder and that frozen embryos are murder. 100%. Doesn't matter what happens, doesn't matter circumstances, it just is. And of course, the issue at hand here is when is a fetus a personhood, right? When is someone considered personhood? And we could even ask that at the end of life. When do we pull the plug? When is personhood over, right? And so she would quote things and has quoted scripture. Of course, there's always a scripture behind it, you know, Psalm 139 and scriptures like that. And part of me is like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I have not landed where I sit on the abortion issue, but I know that I haven't done my work fully. And I'm all for, hey, don't stand on positions you don't know anything about yet, Jackie, you know? And so, but I do know that that can't be all there is to her conversation because I do know about Numbers 5, which you in the audience can go check out. And I do know that in the scriptures in the Old Testament, it seems to imply that God took David's firstborn son. And I do know that, yes, there are a million frozen embryos sitting in doctor's offices or wherever they keep them, but also that 70% of eggs that are fertilized in a female body naturally abort. And so what do we do with that, right? When I enter these conversations and I offer opposite evidence, which is also scripturally bound, people don't necessarily shift their beliefs. Mm-hmm. So I learned that the brain actually kicks in when you challenge someone's belief like it's being chased by a bear.
Yeah.
So can you explain that a bit more? What is going on in our bodies? Because I think all of us are going, you hear people say, I can't believe that they believe that, right? And then, no, I can't believe that they believe that, you know?
Right.
Fire away. Tell us, what is going on with us?
So there's sometimes being challenged does set off a threat response for us. And a number of things can lead to that. Knowing that we have to believe a certain set of things in order to be accepted in our social group or in our church or in our intimate relationships or our families makes it scary to consider changing our beliefs. Because underneath that fear is sometimes a fear of abandonment, a fear of being ostracized or kicked out or shunned. So if we had healthier cultures that allowed for disagreement, we wouldn't go into so much fear overdrive when we look at different beliefs. So that's a big thing for a lot of people. especially those who are entrenched in conservative, high-control religious groups, which I grew up in. And so I know that fear very intimately. I remember being afraid to challenge my belief on young earth creationism. Even when I got to seminary, I was like, oh, there's a lot of really solid Bible scholars who think there's a lot of different theories of creation, not just like young earth creation. Oh, okay. But I can't challenge that or I will lose the respect of my church community. So it becomes a fear thing to look at changing our beliefs because we are what we're really afraid of is losing community. And that's a deep, deep human fear. So it goes to our attachment fears, et cetera.
Yeah.
So when we're called on to change our beliefs, but we know even on a subconscious level that that means ostracization, we can't really engage the argument. We have to protect our relationships. And so much of that happens, if we're not self-aware, that is all happening under the surface. We do not know what's going on. We do not know why we have such a big reaction, but it is a huge fear. So I really love, there's a model of the mind called internal family systems, and I'm trained in it. That's what I use as a coach. It's a therapeutic modality, but also just like a model of understanding ourselves. Anyway, the idea is that we have all these protective parts that we form throughout our lives, and we get internal conflict when these protective parts of us are warring with each other. But the idea is that we all have a self that is like the non-reactive, who we really are, like the image of God in us, who we're really created to be. And when we're in that place of self-energy, of what I think Galatians calls self-control, when we're in that space, we have endless compassion and curiosity. And so when we can get in that space of self-control, then we can consider all these different arguments and not have fear. But the minute that abandonment fear and self-protection leaps in, we're going to react with fear and violence. Even if it's verbal violence, we're going to start political sparring. But if both people having that discussion can keep themselves in that space of self-control or self-energy, then they can have truly productive conversations because then they're not driven by these subconscious fears.
This is something that I've definitely experienced in loss of community. And I've thought a lot about there's so much fear behind both things I said and didn't say in losing community and things that other people said to me in that. And so when we find ourselves in those exact moments of conversation where maybe things are getting heated, maybe it's about a certain theology or politics like we're talking about, what is a practical thing that our listeners can do in that moment to help our sympathetic nervous system to find ourself and to calm that down?
I mean, there's work that we need to do outside of those conversations proactively. We all need to be doing our inner work. We should all probably be in therapy. Learning self-awareness and self-regulation skills and practicing those skills, because the more we can identify our own triggers, our own the issues that make us reactive and what's leading to that, the wounds from our childhood and our growing up years and our intimate relationships that lead us to be reactive in our lives now because we fear that the same bad things are happening to us over again. A lot of those are trauma responses. Like if we can heal our trauma, then we'll be in a place to have those conversations. So it's not just what we do in a conversation. It's the work we do outside of it to make ourselves healthy, more calm, more stable, more healed humans. That's a huge piece of it. When we're in a conversation where we're starting to get flooded, like when we're feeling threatened, often our prefrontal cortex goes offline and we go into trauma responses or reactivity or fear responses. So in that moment, we need to be able to recognize, I am feeling really flooded right now, or I'm feeling really reactive. I'm not going to be able to have a productive conversation. So instead of speaking from these reactive parts of me that think that I'm still 8 years old and need to protect myself from bullies on the playground, I'm like, I am acting like an 8-year-old right now because that 8-year-old in my memory is like being triggered right now. I need to remember that I'm an adult. So I'm going to take a minute, and it takes probably 15 minutes to like unflood if we're feeling really reactive. So it's to walk away, calm ourselves down, do belly breathing, like box breathing, where you like breathe in for 4 seconds, hold it, breathe out for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, and just do that box for a few minutes. That will actually calm our nervous system, stop the reactivity, then re-enter the conversation from a calm and centered place and continue to engage that curiosity, that compassion, that search for connection and clarity, and then continue a conversation.
So really, it does involve pausing when we're reactive instead of, because if we just keep reacting, their parts are going to react and we're going to be like a bunch of 8-year-olds yelling at each other because we've really abandoned our adult selves.
So you said work we need to do before. And then you said learn to self-regulate. What are some ways that women can learn to self-regulate? Let's say they're going home for Thanksgiving or they're going to have a conversation with somebody about their voting. What do they do beforehand? Because not everybody knows what self-regulating is.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of books you can get. If you want to look at it from a Christian perspective, Allison Cook has a couple of good books. Dr. Allison Cook. One is called Boundaries for Your Soul, and the other one is called The Best of You, I think. So those are IFS books for internal family systems from a Christian perspective, and they give a lot of the understanding of how to do that kind of self-regulation work, to be aware of these reactive parts of you, how to heal those wounded inner child parts that you're still carrying around. So that's a good place to start. A couple of other Frank Anderson and Dick Schwartz are a couple of other good authors to look up and read their books on IFS. There are a lot of modalities for self-regulation. IFS just happens to be my favorite one, but there are a lot of options. Learning about emotions. What is that new? It's on my shelf.
Which they're going to be able to do from you very soon when you finish your PhD.
Yes. Well, in 2 years when I finish my dissertation, right? There's a new book by Jenny Allen. I was looking for it on my shelf. Untangle Your Emotions. But it's a good starting point. Like if you don't have much emotion education, she did a really nice job giving a very accessible, very readable book on emotions and regulating your emotions. So Untangle Your Emotions by Jenny Allen is a good option. If you want to get into the science, but a still readable book, How Emotions Are Made by Lisa Feldman Barrett and Between Us by Bacha Mesquita about social emotions. They're scientific, but they're very readable. And that would help you just understand what emotion is and then how to handle it. So reading, obviously I'm a big fan of reading, but not everyone is. So if you can see a good therapist, particularly if you can identify the traumatic things that have happened to you, if you've been in a relationship with intimate partner violence, if you were abused by your parents, if you were sexually assaulted as a child, if you lived in poverty, you know, go online and look at the ACEs score, like adverse childhood experiences, see what your ACEs score is. And if you score higher on that, be like, okay, I probably have some childhood trauma that I need to work with a therapist on. So finding a trauma-informed therapist, not just talk therapy, but someone who's going to engage your body and your mind in healing those deep wounds that are causing your reactivity, embodied empathetic witness is going to be so healing for you. And when you have healed yourself, you're in a better position to heal other people instead of continuing to wound others.
Thank you. Love it. That's lots of resources. We'll get them written out for you guys. So I know if you're driving somewhere, you're going, I can't write those down. So we'll get them to you. So last week, I sat with a woman and she's an older woman, a woman of faith for a long time. So giving her the standard, like hope is in Jesus. She gets all that, right? Like, again, this is not the answer I want here, but she's gotten herself to a place where if her candidate doesn't win, she feels like she might not be able to cope with that. Like she's even saying, I need to brace myself for the grief I'm going to feel if this doesn't happen. And part of me, when I heard her say that, was legitimate in that she is wanting to see sexism abolished in the United States. And she's been in Christian ministry her whole life and has experienced sexism as a woman in the church. And so this is a really strong issue for her and a personal issue for her. And now she's afraid that she won't be able to have hope if her candidate doesn't get picked. And I've heard people say this on all sides.
Yeah.
So this isn't just one-sided. So if you were to coach us, how would you prepare us for the elections, particularly if our candidate doesn't win?
Right. I think some of it is the football team effect. I'm going to get serious in a minute, but I'm going to say the lighthearted thing first. Some of it is the football team effect. If our football team loses, we might feel devastated for days, but it doesn't really matter. It's just that we've tied our identity and favoritism to a team. And if they lose, we feel like it's a loss for us. And so we feel grief, distress, etc. To some extent,
I don't watch any sports, so I can't resonate with that. But I trust you because I've seen other people.
So to some extent, I think that a two-party system leaves people in that I've identified myself and my values with a party. If they don't win, I feel like I have lost because I'm identified with a losing team, right? So we feel that loss on a visceral level
but to some extent, it's a team, right? So that's kind of a lighthearted thing. I think we are feeling that, but I do not want to diminish the very real fear that especially women are feeling if they see that a candidate doesn't respect women, in fact, is anti-woman, and is actually going to truly curtail their freedoms and abilities. That's a true, real concern, and it is okay to feel that fear. That fear is valid. It's okay to feel that anger. I would hope that people can like self-assess and construct emotions that help them take positive action instead of taking like pivoting toward hopelessness, despondency, giving up.
Despair. Yep.
There are always things we can do. We can get involved in local politics. We can get involved in national politics. We can support the candidates we believe in. We can work for policy change on a local level. We can support nonprofit organizations that work for change. There are things we can do. We can make women's lives better in our spaces. We can do research. We can write books. We can apply for grants. Like, there's so many things we can do. So our anger and our fear will hopefully drive us to action toward our goals, toward protecting women, not on giving up.
So, and let me pause right here, because you just like opened the door for me to pitch for money, but you should support organizations that actually are trying to reshape the view of women theologically, like the Marcella Project. Yes, you just rolled me right into that. Because the truth is, we actually have to support organizations, policy, everything that we can that is changing that view, including our money. So, I don't normally do that, but I was like, wait, yes.
That is a thing we can do, is use our material resources to support organizations, thought change organizations, like reshaping belief. That's really important. We can all do work in our lives to help the women we know. So I would just encourage people to construct anger and to construct fear, not in a terrified, overwhelmed, shut down kind of way, but instead of constructing hopelessness and despondency, let's construct anger that moves us to take action toward making the world a better place for women. But yes, women's fears are valid.
Yeah, this is truly, a lot of women are really feeling it in this election. And I even think that if all women were paying attention, we are going to be the pivotal people group that decides where this goes. All women are not in agreement with that, but
sexual trauma triggers are a very real part of this election, and we cannot avoid that. Like, that needs to be talked about. And if you don't want it on the podcast, I won't be offended.
No, I do. Let's explain a little bit. What are you talking about?
So in 2016, during the election cycle, when I heard the Access Hollywood tapes about Trump bragging about groping women, I dissociated in my kitchen because it literally triggered my own sexual trauma. And I was standing there making coffee and was like outside of my body. That's a trauma trigger. And it's only gotten worse since then. When you have a candidate for president who has lost a civil case on sexual assault, and there's evidence of many other sexual assaults, for women to see people voting for that candidate is terrifying, because it says you don't care about sexual assault victims. How can you vote for someone who has raped women and girls? And do you, like, does my rape not matter to you? Does my assault not matter to you? So that anger is real, valid, important, and also probably trauma driven. For a lot of women, it's not a case of policy differences. It's, I see the people around me supporting a sexual criminal, and I'm not okay with that because it is bringing all of my trauma to the surface.
How are those women to have a conversation with somebody who's pro, we'll just say it at this moment, pro-Trump, right? How are they to engage that, since that, again, emotionally loaded for them, right?
The women don't owe anyone their trauma story. You should not have to trot out your trauma to make a point. And it sucks that so many women have to, because sometimes people will not listen to you until you tell them the terrible things that have happened to you. But it's re-traumatizing to have to tell that story to people over and over again. But if you have the strength and the support to do it, and you feel you want to give someone that gift, because telling your trauma story is a gift, to say, this is my experience with sexual assault, and here is why I will never vote for a candidate who thinks of women that way and treats women that way. And pull up evidence if you need to, and ask that question. Why is this about policy for you? What all I hear you saying is that you don't value women.
and their bodily autonomy in the terms, not even talking about abortion, but like our right to not be assaulted and our safety in the world.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing up bodily autonomy, because I think too often in the United States now, whenever we talk about bodily agency or whatever, people immediately go to the abortion issue,
right?
Which is a part of that conversation, but it feels like it's the only conversation. And it's like, there's so much more to our bodily agency here.
Yes. Yeah.
That has to do with like what you just described.
I deserve to not be groped. I deserve to not be forcibly kissed. I deserve to not be raped in a department store or dressing room. I deserve not to be leered at. Like, my body deserves safety and protection. And I want politicians who respect that with their life.
Well said. Mm-hmm. I love that. We didn't intend to go there, but Becky, you took us there. And I am so okay with that. I know right now that our listeners are thinking, geez, how do I keep following more of her? And how do I get on her coaching list? And how do I get into her counseling and all of that stuff? So tell us where they can find you.
On Instagram, I'm at Whole Emotion, WholeEmotion. And I also have a Substack and a website, BeckyCastleMiller.com, talking about emotions and emotional health. Now that summer vacation is over and I'm back into the swing of the school year, I'm ready to start making content in those spaces again. So that's where I give a lot of free advice and insight on emotions and sharing the research that I'm doing. I do have a contact form on my website if people are interested in coaching. My load is almost full right now since I am a full-time PhD student and have 5 kids. But if I can't take on clients, I am happy to refer to other coaches who do the same work that I do.
Great. Thank you, Becky. We're glad you're here. And for those of you listening, I pray something in this conversation helps you navigate the conversations that you're having around this election year. And if not anything else, I pray that you feel highly, highly heard and validated as women. Have a great day, y'all.
Hey, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then hop on over to the Marcella Project. Sign up for our email and check out our other resources that we have to offer. You can also find me on the Marcella Project Facebook page and on every other platform and social media. Have a great day.